Hi, everyone. This is Diane McBain. I played the Mad Hatter's sidekick, Lisa, on the original Batman TV series, as well as Pinky Pinkston in the classic face-off between Batman and the Green Hornet. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey there, superhero fans. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber, and I'm coming at you from the Comic Book Central lair. Thanks so much for joining me here today. Another cool conversation on tap. I am time tripping all the way back to Batman 66 today with my special guest who appeared in two, count them, two Batman tales with Adam West and Burt Ward as two completely different characters. One of those tales is the classic Batman-Green Hornet team-up. Now, if you're new to Comic Book Central, after you listen to today's show, you're going to want to go back and check out episode 76. That is where I talked to the Green Hornet himself, Van Williams. We talked about those very episodes. Today's show, I'm talking to the lovely and talented lady who shared the screen with Batman and the Green Hornet. Really looking forward to welcoming the versatile actress Diane McBain to the Comic Book Central lair. She is also an author. We will talk about her autobiography. It's titled Famous Enough, a Hollywood Memoir. And of course, we are going to talk about those classic Batman episodes. Before we get to that, I want to give you a heads up. If you're not listening to the IndieCast, that is the world's number one Indiana Jones podcast, well, you really should be listening to it, first of all. Producer and host Ed Dollesty puts on an amazingly comprehensive and entertaining show all about our favorite archaeologist adventure. But I want to let you know that very, very soon I'm going to be touring the Indiana Jones exhibition in Washington, D.C. with my IndieCast buddy, Keith Voss. We're going to be recording a segment while we're there. Hope to do some interviews with some of the folks who are putting the exhibition together, who brought it to the nation's capital. So be sure to stay tuned to the IndieCast for that rundown. It's going to be at theindiecast.com. That is the website, theindiecast.com. Our DC visit is coming soon to that podcast. I think you're really going to enjoy it. All right, that is for a later date. Right now, it is time for some Batman 66. Take a listen to this, and I'm going to be right back to chat with the actress who spent some time with the dynamic duo, the equally dynamic and downright delightful Diane McBain. Diane McBain was born in Cleveland, Ohio, but her family moved to Glendale, California when Diane was very, very young. As a teenager, her plays and commercial work got the attention of the higher-ups at Warner Brothers, and Diane was signed to a contract with the mega studio. Tapped as the studio's answer to Grace Kelly and Marilyn Monroe, Diane found herself just about everywhere on the small screen and the big screen. In her first feature, Ice Palace, she held her own with Hollywood heavyweights Richard Burton and Carolyn Jones. And she showed up on the biggest television hits of the day, including Maverick, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., 77 Sunset Strip, The Wild Wild West, and Bourbon Street Beat and Surfside 6 with future Green Hornet Van Williams. Diane would reunite with Van on the classic Batman Green Hornet episodes in season 2 of Batman, but her first trip into the world of the Caped Crusaders actually took place in season 1. In the two-parter The 13th Hat and Batman Stands Pat, Diane plays Lisa, the mesmerizing minion of the Mad Hatter. In the second season of the comic book-themed television juggernaut, Diane was asked back to play a different role, and this time she was on the right side of the law, playing Pinky Pinkston, owner of the Pink Chip Stamp Company, where there are some nefarious ne'er-do-wells committing crimes right under Pinky's nose and her wildly coiffed pink hair. For this two-parter, a piece of the action and Batman's satisfaction, in come the dynamic duo, and in come Green Hornet and Kato to investigate. And right alongside the crime fighters, Diane scored a guest appearance that lives on with Batman fans to this day. Around the same time, Diane was also gaining attention for her role alongside the King of Rock and Roll in the Elvis Presley musical comedy Spin Out, and for her work in two trips to Vietnam for the USO, for which she received the Special Service Award. In a relatively short amount of time, Diane had a lifetime of experiences in her career in Hollywood, her world travels, and her time spent in Vietnam. But nothing could have prepared her for what happened in 1982. That year, Diane was sexually assaulted, an event that she details in her autobiography. Following the attack, she showed unbelievable strength by turning that tragic situation into a chance to help others by becoming an advocate for survivors of rape. Diane continues to be a force for positive change in the lives of many with her counseling and charity work, and she continues to entertain and amaze a new generation of fans discovering her incredible work. Now, my guest today is an actress who has appeared alongside the Caped Crusaders, the Green Hornet and Kato, and the King of Rock and Roll. She is also an author. Her book, Famous Enough, a Hollywood Memoir, is available on Amazon. A big welcome to Diane McBain. Diane, welcome to Comic Book Central.
I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. This is awesome. Hey, we're big on anniversaries here at the Comic Book Central Lair.
Yeah.
It doesn't get a whole lot bigger than 50th anniversary of the Batman television series. We're close. We're awful close to that. Can you believe all these years? I mean, look, we're comic book fans. I can believe we could talk about this. But did you have any idea, even the working with an iconic character and you know, these actors, Adam West and, of course, Van Williams on that episode, any idea we'd still be talking about this right now?
Well, frankly, I didn't think I'd be still alive.
My goodness.
We're talking about 50 years ago.
We are going back a little bit, so.
A little bit. Anyway, no, the answer is no, of course. Who could imagine it?
Isn't that amazing? I don't know how many personal appearances. Do you do many personal appearances throughout the year?
Not anymore.
Okay.
Just occasional ones, yeah.
Okay, so here and there, so if people are interested in having you out, but when you do a personal appearance, and especially with the book, we'll talk about the book as well. Obviously, people are going to want you signing that and buying the book there. But what's the reaction you get from people? Because you've played so many roles. Your roles on Batman, are those the ones that people are kind of locked into?
Quite a lot, yes. Well, Batman was an iconic series, as you know. And, I mean, it will last forever, really, in television land.
Yeah.
And doing that show was just probably one of the better things that I got to do in my career. So it does turn up quite a lot. And, of course, the movie with Elvis, Spinout, comes up a lot because they all love Elvis.
Yeah. There's so many of these, like you mentioned, they're just iconic. And we'll talk about it. And I think even the roles, plural, that you got Batman, I think that probably came at a pretty perfect time, too. In your career. We'll talk a little bit about that. But look, I'm talking to you from the Buckeye State. Yeah, I know. Is that near and dear to your heart, or were you too young when you left?
I was only 4.
Okay.
I don't remember much.
I kind of figured. I wasn't sure how old you were when you left, but we can say you're a Clevelander, right?
Oh, sure. That's where I was born.
What motivated your family at that point to move? Because you moved from there to from Cleveland to California, correct?
Yes, we did.
Okay. And, other than the weather, what was the motivating force?
Other than the weather, well, that was of course one of the primary reasons. But my father was in the Navy. He was out in the Mediterranean at the time. It was in the middle of World War II. Well, maybe not at the middle, more like at the end. But my mother and my grandmothers and my aunt all decided that Glendale, California looked like the right place to live. And so we all packed up and got on a train and came west to Glendale. The period of time during which that happened was the war, and so a lot of movement was taking place throughout the country, and I guess we were just part of that migration.
Okay, certainly warmer. I mean, I can't, I know how cold it gets in Cleveland, so.
You don't ever
go back or anything, do you?
Well, no, I don't. I have been back a couple of times, but just so briefly, I couldn't even tell you what the weather was like.
Okay. Well, if you're ever around there, I definitely want to stop by and get that book signed. That would be cool. That'd be cool. Okay. So you go out when you said you're what, 4 years old?
Four. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and then you start modeling at what, 15?
Yeah, that's about right. Sure.
Okay. So what's going on in between there? What are you seeing? What are you watching? How do you become involved in the modeling world? And I guess you get into commercials and some acting. What goes on in that decade that tells you this is what you want to do?
Wow, that's quite a question. well, quite a few things did happen.
You thought I was going back far with Batman, right? let's go all the way back.
No, I was, kind of a typical teenager, honestly. I wanted to be a cheerleader in my high school, and I tried out for that. And the only reason I wasn't able to do it was that I was doing a lot of modeling work at the time for magazine covers and things like that. And I even had done a commercial, Colgate a toothpaste commercial. And, things were kind of looking really good in that area of my life. And the school was not happy because I would miss school. So that was why I couldn't be a cheerleader, because I missed too much school. So I was sort of penalized for getting out there and making a career for myself. But I did anyway.
Yeah, it's kind of strange because it's like you're supposed to be, going through school so you can get out and make money, and you're making money, but they need you.
Right. I mean, it was a little cross purposes there, sure. But I had done a couple of plays, actually, at the Glendale Center Theater, which was just a tiny little house with the living room had been pretty much gutted. The house had been gutted pretty much. And it was a theater in the round with the living room in the middle. And we did a couple of little plays there. And it interested me, but I was not an extremely ambitious person. It was not something that I thought I must do at all costs, at all. In fact, I was sort of confused about what I wanted to do with my life. But I just followed sort of the path of easiest resistance, to be frank, and that was the career.
What was the appeal? Was it performing in front of people? Was it the creativity? What was it about that sort of area that kept you in it, though, obviously long enough to make a successful career?
Yeah, well, I think for every actor, it is the moment in time when you can make a scene work with other people. There's something just really magical about that when it happens, and we always strive for it. And you can't rehearse often enough. You can't do the scenes often enough to be able to get that. But that is what we all strive for. And some people can't even quit the business because they're still, even at the age of 75, looking to create that moment again. So I think that's what it is. I really do.
That we've heard that from so many actors, just that whenever it clicks and you just lock in and it just works and that was it. Now, kind of for our listeners, I mean, again, we're going back a little bit, but put – whole different Hollywood now. I mean, some of the seedy things probably have stayed the same, but a different structure. Put our listeners back in that era of the contract system. And I think you're coming out of almost on the tail end of the contract system with Warner Brothers. Put our listeners in that era. And what was that like? And what were the upside? What was the upside to being in the contract system?
Well, first, I would like to say that everyone should read my book if they want the answer to this question. But I'll give it to you anyway.
Yes, and it is a tell-all. It is definitely a tell-all.
It definitely is. That period of time was a very volatile time, at least at the end of my contract. I was at Warner Brothers for 4.5 years. And it was wonderful to be there because they did everything for you. They gave you your jobs. They gave you your wardrobe. They gave you the cars to drive around. Well, not to drive around in, but at least limos to get to places that the studio wanted you to go to. They paid, obviously, for all of your transportation. When you had to go out of town, I visited so many places in the United States promoting films and that sort of thing. So that was all very exciting and wonderful. And they did that. But then, 4.5 years later, the contract system was falling apart, primarily because of the Sherman Antitrust Act, which said you can't have monopolies. And the studios had monopolies because they owned the theaters that the movies were shown in. So when when they made the ruling that we couldn't do that anymore, the studios, the contract system just fell apart. It just had no reason to be anymore. And the independents and other entities came in to fill the void. That was the hard part. I was like, go for my contract. And I was only 22 years old. I mean, I was just a baby. And I had to then, start from scratch and build a team of people, which I honestly did not know how to do. I'd never had to do it. Nobody had ever said, this is what you must do. It was just something that you all of a sudden you realized, oh my goodness, I have to have a team of people. And of course, I didn't have a lot of money. It's not like my contract gave me tons of money. It certainly did not. And I didn't spend it very wisely anyway. I was so young.
I think it was like, what was it, anyway, $350 a week or something like that? Which
I think I was at $450 a week by the time I left.
Yeah, no, I mean, not bad money for back in the day, but I mean, still not enough.
It was okay. Yeah,
you're not retiring on that.
It was not a fortune, believe me. And it wasn't even enough to save in the bank because there were so many expenses involved with being an actor and presenting yourself properly to the public. Because in those days, boy, you really had to. That was the period of time. It was during the Vietnam War. It was during the Civil Rights Movement. There were all sorts of things happening in the country at the time that just created a very volatile kind of situation throughout. And it certainly touched the movie industry, and it certainly touched my career, because I was sort of, just because I guess of my appearance, I was kind of the old school. I was a glamour girl. And during the 60s, suddenly this hunger from the public came along for a more ordinary girl being a hero and having a real life, not the kind of phony life that, the glamour girls used to have.
That was almost like coming out of the 50s, I think, like maybe like the late 50s, because you had like Marilyn Monroe and that kind of thing. Was that was that the kind of thing, was that you were going to be the next it girl and they were kind of like, let's put her in that mold or something like that?
Well, I kind of belonged in that sort of mold, unfortunately. I mean, physically you can't change your looks. So, and I tried.
a knockout is a knockout, right?
Yeah, really. But there's just certain things that you can't change. And I was miscast quite a few times in independent movies, like the miniskirt mob. I was supposed to be the head of this motorcycle gang. And it was just really ridiculous because I didn't look like the leader of any motorcycle gang. And even the bikes that they had us use were so small. They were only 160 Hondas. I had been riding around on a 350. And really, if you were going to be the head of a motorcycle gang, you'd be on a 600. You wouldn't be on a tiny 350 or a 160.
You channeled some scary places with that role, though. I mean, you did an amazing job with it.
Yeah, well, I get dumped off a cliff by Shirley Jackson.
Yes, spoiler alert, right, for somebody that hasn't seen it in 40-some years,
really good.
you don't make it all the way to the credits, so... let's talk about some of these, because we're coming in. And well, before we get to that, I want to ask you, how did you personally overcome that fear of everything's taken care of for you to now you're on your own? How did you as an actress overcome that fear? And really, I mean, you just started getting one role after another here.
Well, truthfully, I don't know that I ever did. Even today, would find that a difficult thing to deal with. It's like running a business. And the people who do extremely well, you know, they're able to parlay their talent into a super career. Now, unless you're a superstar, don't even think about it. You know, you're just not going to be in the high earning categories. You have to be a superstar today. And that, of course, is because the studio system is no longer there to do that work. So, I think it's the exclusive area of very few people who can actually get far enough to do that.
It looks like you also threw yourself into some serious environments, too. 66 and 67, I mean, we'll talk about Batman in 66, but right in that era, you're mm-hmm. over in Vietnam with Bob Hope mm-hmm. on the, on the, the USO shows?
Well, yes, they were USO shows. And I was there actually with Johnny Grant, who took the smaller group of girls and himself, who he was a comedian, he was the jokester, and he would take us out into the outlying areas in Vietnam where the Bob Hope troop could never get to because they were so big. They could stay in Saigon and Da Nang and places like that. We visited with them and were on the stage with them, but our job was to get out to the outer areas where the troops were hunkered down in the trenches kind of thing, and that's what we did.
What impact on you did that experience have?
Oh, tremendous. I think that was kind of life-changing, especially the second trip. The first one was, the war was sort of humming along and pretty okay, and not too many people were as upset as they became during the next year. And by 67, people were really riled up in the anti-war effort. And also in Vietnam itself, that mood was being felt, I think, and I think that the men were also having a lot of problems. It was a different atmosphere totally from the first time I was there in 66. So that was quite a change for me. We went to a field hospital at one time, and I, of course, talk about that in my book. It was a very traumatic situation for me. I was totally unprepared. And I reacted just like such a silly girl, honestly. But, you know, emotion is emotion, and I could not suppress mine. Anyway, it's a good section in my book. If anybody's interested in the history of the Vietnam War, I think they might get something out of those two chapters that I included. I wrote home to my parents during both. And so you
I was going to ask you, the letters, you put, they're both in there, right? From both.
Yes. Yeah, from that period. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, so you take us edited. Right back to what you were thinking. That's amazing when you're there, mm-hmm. too. All right, well, all these different environments, one amazing story after another. Let's talk about some of these roles. We talked about the king. Before we get to the superheroes, let's talk about the king of rock and roll.
Okay.
The movie was Spin Out. What surprised you most about Elvis Presley? I mean, so many stories. You probably heard a lot of stories coming into it.
Sure. Of course I did. And most of those stories, turned out to be kind of true. He did have an entourage, and he was the king. no doubt.
He did not disappoint, right?
Anyway, I found him to be a very spiritual person, which was totally unexpected. And the two of us were like a couple of kids together on the set, sitting in our chairs in between scenes, sharing the things that we were reading about and the stuff that fascinated us and how interesting it all was. And it was fascinating, and it was the beginning of, toward the beginning of my spiritual journey. I always had one, but more conscious efforts on my part began with him and certainly continued because of that experience with him.
How did you, what were your conversations like about as far as the acting and the scenes? Because, sometimes he gets knocked for, his acting, and you know, some of the movies are a little, you know, more on the lighter side and things like that. But what kind of conversations did you, because you obviously had a lot of experience coming into this acting, what kind of conversations did you have with him about just rehearsing the scenes?
Well, you know, I don't know that we ever had much of a conversation about it. We just did it. He was very well prepared. He liked to rehearse, which I also like to do, so we would run lines. And he was just a professional in every respect. Now, you know, whether you think his talent as an actor was wonderful or not, that's, I think, another issue. And that has more to do with the kinds of roles you get in life. Absolutely, you know, the Academy Award winners would never be on that stage if it were not for the roles that they were given to play. It's the story that, to me, is the most important part. And the characters in that story, when they can become alive for the audience, that's such a coup, you know? Anyway, I don't know how I got off on that, but but he, you know, he didn't have those opportunities to do those kinds of roles. He just didn't. You know,
it was kind of like, I mean, something like maybe what you were facing too, and like they were trying to put you in this little mold. I think they kind of put him in this mold. A lot of his movies are variations on a theme, you know.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
Yeah, the rock and roll race driver, the rock and roll cowboy. I think they kind of played to his strengths on that. I'm going to back up a little bit here too. One of your, I guess, was it your first role on Maverick?
I think one of them was. Yeah, it was. The Passage to Fort Doom.
Okay. What was that experience like for you so young?
The first time I was on Maverick, I was with Jack Kelly. He was the star on that particular show. And he was so charming and very sweet. And he gave me my first screen kiss, which, of course, was a very gentle and very sweet kiss, not a little bit romantic, but not sexy in the least. And and I was just, you know, this kid coming out of high school, sitting on a rock next to this movie star, television star. And can you imagine? I mean, come on. That is a moment, isn't it?
Right out of the gate, that's amazing to be in that. That had to be that probably strengthened you for all the roles to come too. I mean, you probably it's got to be a quick learning curve.
Well, once you get a little experience, you feel better about yourself, of course. And every time I got out there and had more of an opportunity, you know, the better it got, the easier it got. That sort of thing. Sure.
Well, one opportunity you definitely had, series work, Surfside 6, as Daphne Dutton. Okay, so you, look, we'll talk about the great Van Williams here in a little bit. Friend of Comic Book Central, the Green Hornet. Green Hornet, that wasn't your first time appearing with Van Williams. You appear with Van Williams a lot. Surfside 6. Was even The Caretakers? Were you in The Caretakers with him?
Yes. Yes, he was in The Caretakers.
Okay, yeah. Bourbon Street Beat. To talk about the chemistry and just working with Van Williams.
Oh, well, Van chemistry, All right, Van was a friend. He was a dear, sweet, kind human being. He was very much married to his wife, and he was very much a family man. So chemistry is not the word I would use. We were good together. I thought we worked well together. I never had any romantic scenes with him that I recall. I'm fairly certain I didn't do that with him.
Had you known Van personally before you worked with him?
Well, no, just because we were on the series together. Okay. That's how I knew him. Yeah. Okay.
But you became friends. In real life. Yeah, right, off screen too.
Yeah.
So,
sure.
And
his wife was wonderful. Yeah.
How did he approach roles? How did he approach his roles? And then what were you able to learn from him?
You know, Van always struck me as the kind of person who is very direct, no fuss, no muss, We just get in there and we do the job. And he happened to have been a gorgeous human being. I have to say that about him. He you talk about a six-pack, my goodness. And he just was, and because he was so sweet and kind, it was a great combination. So I can't say I learned a lot from him so much as I just, you know, we all kind of folded into each other as a group. Troy and Van and Lee Patterson and Margarita Sierra, we were the people on the show who were the regulars, and we just kind of folded into each other. We don't, none of us had to have a lot of experience. Probably Marguerite had more performance experience than any of us did because she was a singer. But we just, you know, we just worked together and worked out whatever little problems came up. I don't know. I never found it to be very difficult. It was just always fun.
Yeah, it seems like on Surfside 6, there were different episodes geared toward the different characters. I'm guessing your favorite episode was Daphne, Girl Detective.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. What did you think when you got the script for that one?
Oh, well, I was happy. I mean, you know, I was supposed to have a few shows that were supposed to be mine, so that was sort of in the contract, so to speak. And so that was one of them. And I was just delighted. It was fun. Those scripts were never very serious. I mean, these were detective shows, but not like detective shows are today. My goodness, in the detective shows today, they're all, you know, hunkered over the evidence and, oh, it's all very serious business. But back then, you know, it was more a game to be played. Yeah. And very, very unserious, more or less kinds of shows. Although, I mean, you know, people would get killed and stuff like that. You always have to have something happening. but it wasn't terribly, terribly serious.
Do you think being on television and being so prominent in so many households and people kind of get to know those characters and see people? Because I'm thinking, you know, you kind of come out of these roles and then you end up doing, I think it just becomes almost a struggle to get movie parts, especially like you said, being freelance at some point, mm-hmm. and not being in the studio machine. Do you think just that, mm-hmm. that recognition on television kind of hurts the movie aspect of it for some, like even Van Williams, because you mentioned it's like he had the look, he had everything. Why wasn't he like this massive movie star?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a very fair question, and that is, I think, the problem. I remember back then, of course, TV was new, and I remember Jane Fonda saying, I will not appear in television because it will ruin my movie career. And she was right. She had a movie career, even if it was Barbarella, but still, it was there, and she continued, even to this day. Of course, she does television now. But that's quite different. She does HBO things and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, she did make that rule for herself, and I think it was a very wise thing to do. I was unable to make such a rule because I was under contract, and I had to do what the studio asked me to do.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's a blessing and a curse on so many different levels. But let's talk about Batman. How did you get involved in the world of the Caped Crusader and two different roles, which is actually kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. They were very different. Well, actually, the truth of the matter is that I knew Aaron Spelling. And Aaron passed on to me all sorts of opportunities, not only in the shows that he produced himself, but other opportunities as well. And I got hired into those shows, I think, because of that, honestly. It was a time after my contract, so it was not easy to get roles. But I was really fortunate, I think, in this particular instance, that these folks seemed to like me, and they seemed to pass things my way. So that's probably the most of the story I can tell you about why I did Batman at all.
Yeah, early mid first season. So now, had you seen or heard of the show up to the point where you got the role? And these are in the as you're playing the Mad Hatter's sort of mall. Is it called a mall back? Lisa. Yeah, the little sort of henchwoman there. Yeah. Had you heard of the show coming into that?
Oh, I had, and okay. I think I had even seen it, but it was certainly not an ordinary television show.
Yeah.
And going on to the set, I honestly wasn't sure what I was going to be doing in those roles. And I, you know, just kind of went along with how the script was written and played off of the comedy expertise of the people that I was working with. So that's pretty much how I did it.
Yeah, I know at that time they talk about Batmania sweeping through. And if you didn't live at that time, you can't really get it. It's just such like a pop culture phenomenon that hit. Had Batmania, was it just building when you had found out about it? Or had you got a sense that, oh, this is sweeping the country? Like, I'm trying to gauge at what point, how big Batmania was at that point when you worked on your first episode.
Well, it was a big deal, and it had swept the country by that time. I was just really excited that I was able to get a role with them. I was uncertain about myself in that context, but I certainly was extremely happy.
Your first two episodes, you do obviously they're all shot in two, cliffhangers. So you got Batman Stands Pat and the 13th Hat. Talk about working with this cast. You got to share a scene with Alan Napier as Alfred.
Yeah.
What was he like to work with? Because he just seems like, there's Hollywood history right there.
Yeah, he was it's a very silly man.
Did you say very silly man?
Yeah, he's kind of silly. But, in a charming way. I don't mean that in a derogatory way at all.
No, I wouldn't have picked up on that. I wouldn't have thought that.
That was just the impression I had of him. He was just kind of silly, and he would go into to his job, his work, with that kind of lighthearted silliness.
Yeah. David Wayne is the Mad Hatter, Jervis Tetch.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a comedy force in that episode.
They were fabulous actors,
yeah.
and fabulous comedy actors. They could do... they could create characters that were just so outrageous and so funny. And of course, they had such a great opportunity on Batman to do that they didn't have in other places.
Do you recall what the shooting schedule was like? Because obviously in television, and they're shooting two episodes, what was the pace like when you were shooting all these things? Because there's so many moving parts, too.
It was always crazy. They never had enough time to do anything really right, I guess you could say. Although they got pretty good at doing things really good. It was always frenetic, always, especially in television and sometimes even in movies. If they were low budget movies, they would only have maybe 17 days to make a whole movie, which is barely more than a week, really, or 2 weeks.
Right.
And And it's when you get into situations like that, it kind of a lot of professionalism. It's required, certainly, but it feels like it's going down the toilet because of all the compromises you have to make. Yeah, it really is.
Well, that's Adam West's book. He's always talking about they wanted to do this, they wanted to do this, and then they just didn't have the money or the time, and they just had to kind of...
Right, always, yeah.
And okay, so you get to work with Van Williams again, coming into the Green Hornet episodes. How did that work that you got the next set of episodes? This is Batman Satisfaction and A Piece of the Action as Pinky Pinkston.
Mm-hmm.
Was it just like they were called up? What a great job you did in the other ones. It's like, oh, let's bring you back for something different.
Honestly, I don't know why they did.
We know why they did, because you were awesome in the first two. That's why.
I guess they figured they could dress me up in pink and I would look good.
There's a lot of pink in that episode, yes. Your dog's pink.
Well, I had to wear a pink wig and I had to wear pink clothes. And pink everything. And
you have a pink dog. The apricot,
with.
The dog is pink.
Yeah.
How did they color the dog?
It was, vegetable coloring that they use. Like, you know, when they do the eggs at Easter time.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Like a dye. Okay. Like a, like a vegetable dye or something. Okay. I'm watching this thing and it's just like, the dog's pink too. They did everything. Okay. Van Williams and Bruce Lee. Okay. Just take us into, and Adam West and Burt Ward. This is the episode. This is it. This, mm-hmm. And like, did you even get a sense at the time, or was it just the this pace was so fast and you're trying to act and move through, or did you get a sense that, whoa, we've got, this is the team up. This is it.
Well, maybe a little bit of that. I can't say that I could dwell on those thoughts for very long because the pace, as you said, was very frenetic.
Yeah.
But yes, there were moments when this was a little bit different. They weren't just doing Batman and they weren't just doing Green Hornet. They were bringing the two together for a particularly different sort of show. And it was iconic in that respect because it was different even for the two of them. And there I was in the middle of this whole thing.
Literally in the middle. You're in the fight scene, I think, in, well, at least in the Mad Hatter ones. You're in the middle of the fight scene, too. Van Williams, when I spoke to him, he mentioned about how, obviously, on the Green Hornet, very serious, very dark take. Batman, very... I know Adam West hates the word campy, but it's a very light light version of that. And Van had mentioned about how when they were appearing on there, that was difficult for him to get the tone. Did you get a sense of that from any? Did he mention anything to you when you guys are talking offset that the tone is just tough to find on this one?
Nope.
Okay.
Didn't come up. Nope. But if that's what his memory is of course, I can understand how that might have happened. But, I mean, he was such a charming man that I don't see how it could have been very difficult for him to acquire that tone, the riper tone, that is.
Were you on set when Burt Ward faced off against Bruce Lee?
Yeah, I think I was there. And I know later it was sort of noted as one of those very funny moments when Bruce Lee was, toying with Ward.
Okay, you say toying. I've heard both. Mm-hmm. I've heard both versions of this. What was your sense? Mm-hmm. Was he toying with him, or was there a little bit of seriousness to your take on it?
Oh, I would say he was just toying with him. I mean, come on, guys will be guys.
Okay, because we always hear these stories where they square up, like, was Bruce Lee really going to go after Burt Ward or something? So
no, heavens no.
Very interesting. Well, what's the reaction you get from fans now when you talk about these episodes? Like when people are coming up to you about it?
Well, people are just so excited to see Pinky. I don't know that we talk very much about the episodes or what went on or anything like that. It's just people, when they see an actor that they've admired so much, they just come up and start babbling away about how much they love you. And, oh, I'm going to have your picture, and oh, I want your autograph, and yes, I'm going to buy the book, and so on and so forth, which is, thank goodness we have that availability to the public to be able to do those things. But, it's a very lighthearted way of being, and I don't know how to explain it. It's just fun to be there, and the people are just having a good time.
Yeah, let's talk about the book. I mean, you mentioned the book. All these different experiences are in there. Not only the Hollywood side, the good and the bad, but you talk about a lot of serious issues in the book as well. I think you get into homelessness. The work that you do with the homeless, women's health issues. And even if people aren't familiar with your story, obviously back in the early 80s, you talk about an assault that you had gone through. And that is detailed in the book as well. What's the reaction you're getting from the book? It's everything's out there. You talk about all these things. What's the reaction you're getting from individuals that are coming in, and how are you able to even help them through your stories?
Oh, well, I feel like I have helped a lot of people by telling my story. From the very beginning, when it first happened, I actually got out there and talked about it, which was not so easy to do in those days because women didn't talk about that kind of thing. They felt embarrassed that it had happened to them. But I didn't feel embarrassed. I felt like I had been attacked. So I wasn't in the least a bit ashamed to get out there and talk about it. And I did. I even traveled to New York to do a Good Morning show or whatever it was. And did quite a few radio shows, just like we're talking, only I would have to be there instead of here in my home talking. And I got out there and I talked a lot about what had happened to me. And I opened the door, I think, I believe I did, because I got a lot of mail for a lot of women who had kept this to themselves, had been raped, had been molested for whatever reasons, and had kept it to themselves because they felt like it was their fault. And, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. So getting out there and talking about that, I think I did, you know, kind of open up a way for some women anyway. And as I said, they wrote to me and thanked me. Then, of course, when it came to writing the book, in the meantime, I'd also written an article in Cosmo Magazine, Cosmopolitan Magazine.
You had that article, and then I also read an article in People Magazine, which you wrote a month after the incident. And
yes, yes.
I'm blown away at your strength. I can't even. I read that, and I'm like, I can't even imagine. I can't even fathom how somebody would write that, would be able to be that succinct, just that strong. Where did you find the strength? This was a month afterward. That People Magazine article. And it's online for people, Hammer. But it's where did you find the strength for that?
You know what? I'm not sure that I wasn't just in shock. Still. You know, you can do an awful lot of things when you're in shock. And a lot of the things that I've had to do in life have had to be done in a state of shock, especially like in Vietnam, for instance, that were incidences there. And certainly that incident of the rape, I don't know. I don't know where that comes from. I just know that I have to get up in the morning and put my feet on the ground and walk forward. That's all I know. And if you keep doing that, I guess that's the way it works out.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's just amazing that you were able to do that. And then to go on and to do all the help you. Talk even about your work, just helping people through PTSD.
Yeah. Well, I had the opportunity about a few years after my incident. I should go back a little bit and say that during my incident, I was really rescued by the Rape Trauma Center at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. And there was a woman who came to my rescue at the hospital. She was there to help me through the process of examination and talking to the police and so on and so forth. And she also provided me with counseling after the incident, which got me through some of the shock and the horrible feelings that come with being a victim of rape. And I got through because they kept reiterating, you're not a victim, you're a survivor. You're here to tell your story, you're a survivor. And so I kind of hung on to that idea because that's a good idea to hang on to. When I got that kind of service from the Rape Trauma Center, a couple of years later, I was able to join them as a part of the counseling team. And as a rape survivor, I, of course, was able to relate to the people who came to me, women who came to me, and who wanted to talk about their incidences of rape and abuse. So for 5 years, I was able to do that under the direction, of course, of a psychiatrist who made sure that the counselors all did the correct kind of job And, you know, that was a very satisfying time because it certainly helped me to sort out my feelings. And it was certainly a time when I could, you know, be of service to others, which is always good.
And it's not just in that area that you're serving, too. We talked about this, too, and I think you mentioned this in the book. Women's health issues, especially in sort of poverty-stricken areas, homelessness.
Well, yeah.
You're an advocate for that, too. Tell us a little bit about that and how we could find out more about how people can help.
Well, I was invited to be on the executive committee of the Iris Cantor Center for Breast Imaging at UCLA. And I was there for a couple of years. I worked with them. And during that period of time, we raised money and did a lot of work in getting a mobile mammogram unit together so that women in poor areas where they have to work long hours and they don't have the time to get to a doctor, or there aren't any clinics available in their area, which is a big problem today as well. But this was a unit that would go out, and it would take the mammogram machine right up to the women and get them to get those breast examinations right then and there.
Oh, wow. So these mobile units that would go in?
That they'd go out. Yeah, mobile units, yes.
Okay.
And that was our big focus. We were able to accomplish it, and it was a model that was copied all over the country. So I feel pretty good about that, too.
Probably one of the vans I used to produce a medical show and got to go on one of these. Yeah, we got to go into an area and take one of those mobile vans in. So, yeah, it's amazing work.
Right.
Amazing work these people do, and you're certainly a part of that. How can fans find out more about you and some of these causes that you're talking about? You're out there. You're getting bigger on social media now, right? You're embracing Facebook world.
I've got a Facebook page. I mean, you know, I never thought I would do that. Without the help of my partner, Michael Michaud, who also helped me write the book, without him, none of this would have happened, actually. He's just the most amazing person. But he decided to do the Facebook, and so we do that together, and it's a lot of fun. I sometimes say things that are explosive on my "What's on your mind today?"
We would expect nothing less from Pinky Pinkston, would we?
Well, I would hope not. Honestly, I like to say explosive things. And he always says, "Now be careful, honey, and you're going to get a lot of negative reactions." I said, "I really don't care, honestly. If I have something on my mind, I want to say it, and I do, and I get a lot of good reactions as well. So that's good. It's fun. I'm not into social media, mind you. I'm just there. And of course I do email. I don't know if that's social media, but anyway, I enjoy what I do, and it is a lot of fun, and it's good to be able to get your voice out there, and it's wonderful to see how many friends I've accumulated. My goodness, I'm just so excited about that.
You can be friends with Diane McBain. This is awesome. This is what the best part about Facebook is. You go through, you know, you follow your career, and then you can get online with you. Yeah, like you said, you're out there chatting with people. What is it? Is it on Facebook? It's just your name?
Yes, it's my name. Now, unfortunately, I started to do one a long time ago, and then I lost my nerve, and I stopped. But I can't remember my password, so I can't erase it.
It might be in the back computer. You might have to go check out the back computer for that one to be
able. Yeah, maybe I will. Maybe I should consult them.
Or we'll get the Green Hornet on it. We'll get the Green Hornet on that right away. I'm sure he'll be able to
solve the problem.
He always solves the problem. Look, you're having dinner with Bruce Wayne and Britt Reid all the time. I'm sure one of them could work that out for you, right?
I suppose.
Any upcoming appearances? I mean, can fans hope to see you and get a book signed somewhere?
Not at the moment, but if you go on my Facebook page and you're interested in purchasing the book and you want my signature on that book personally to you, just request that, and you will get my mailing address, and you will be able to request a book from me, and I will sign it, and I will send it to you.
That would be awesome.
So, There you go.
What more could we want? The book is famous enough, a Hollywood memoir. I love that title.
Thank you.
Amazing stories, amazing woman that you are. I hope you're going to make some personal appearances next year for Batman's 50th anniversary. That would be so cool to see Pinky Pinkston in person.
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
all
maybe
they have to do is invite me, you know.
You'll be signing Blu-rays, you'll be signing pictures. That'd be fantastic. I thank you so much for everything. I thank you for appearing on Comic Book Central today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Diane has done and continues to do some amazing work. If you have not yet read her autobiography, Famous Enough, a Hollywood Memoir, I highly recommend it. We can really only scratch the surface of her incredible life and career here on this show, but the book tells the tale. It's available on Amazon. I'm going to put a link up in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. There you can find the book. You can go pick it up. I'm also going to put a link to Diane's Facebook page as well. You can get the book that way. Folks, once again, my thanks to Diane for joining me on the show today. I really appreciate that. My website is where you can find each and every episode of Comic Book Central. If you are new to the show, then there is a lot out there for you to hear. You got some time off this month? Take Comic Book Central with you wherever you go. Binge listen. You can share it with your comic book loving friends and family. As you heard on today's show, comic books are just a part of what we chat about here on Comic Book Central. So many of these amazingly talented folks have incredible stories to tell. They often share them right here in the lair. So you want to go back and check out those past episodes you might have missed. The website, comicbookcentral.net. Facebook, it's facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Don't forget the network. On Twitter, it's @comicbookctrl. I really appreciate it when you retweet the show, you share it on Facebook, you hashtag share the lair. Retweet them out there. Get them out there to your friends and family. I really appreciate it. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes. I appreciate if you leave a review while you're there. For those folks that have done that, again, my thanks to you. If you don't use iTunes, you can also catch the show on Blueberry and Stitcher. And hey, I want to know what you think. Drop me a line. Joe@comicbookcentral.net. Get those emails in there, or you can click the Signal Me tab on the website. I get them that way. Your message arrives at the lair. I will read it on the air. All right, kids, that's it for today. I think Diane and I are going to go out and meet up with Britt Reed and Bruce Wayne for some dinner. That should be fun. But I'll be right back because next week on Comic Book Central, I am not done talking about that Batman Green Hornet team up. No, I am not. My guest next week, he revisited that 1960 story by writing a brand new DC comic book sequel. It's called Batman 66 Meets the Green Hornet. It is awesome. The artwork is amazing. The writing is amazing. He is a huge Adam West Bat fan. He also appeared in Marvel's Agent Carter, which is awesomely cool. He hosts a wildly successful podcast along with his buddy Kevin Smith. He is Ralph Garman, and he's going to be joining me in the lair next week. I hope you'll join us. Same bat time, same bat channel. Until then, have a fantastic week. Keep reading those comic books, and thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivations, 3.0 imported license. All the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
Me? Batman?
A lot of people think so, Britt. And that Bruce is the Green Hornet.
Yes, Batman.
Commissioner, do me a favor. Miss Pinkston's in the Camellia Room. Would you call her at once on your regular phone and then hold the two phones together?
Oh, certainly, Batman.
I wonder what's keeping you.
Call for you, Miss Pinkston.
Thank you. Hello?
This is Batman.
Batman?
Yes, Miss Pinkston. I want to thank you for cooperating with me and your police department in running down your felonious foreman. and apparently chasing the Green Hornet out of town.
I did nothing, Batman, but it was sweet of you to call. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Now, does that disprove your ridiculous theory?
I guess it does. Oh, here comes Bruce now. Please don't tell him. He'd think I was an awful fool.
Bet he would, Pinky.
Sorry, my car keys were in my pocket all the time. Now, Apricot, you were saying...
Bruce, you nut! Talking to a dog?